So we're pleased to have today and tomorrow Edward Frankel from UC Berkeley for a distinguished lecture series. His title is Langland's Program in Mirror Symmetry.
Yes.
Edward was educated in Moscow and at Harvard and has been at Berkeley for a good while now. I don't have his bio because he doesn't have it on his website. Nevertheless, we're very happy to have him.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here. Two talks are about some really exciting developments which happened in the last 3 or 4 years, which link two very interesting subjects in mathematics and physics. And one of them is the Langlands program in mathematics, and the other one is mirror symmetry and S-duality in physics. So let me start by giving a brief overview of the history of this subject. In the late 60s, Robert Langlands came up with what is now known as the Langlands program, with the goal to find unifying trends between two subjects, number theory and harmonic analysis. So Langland's program is meant to describe a very wide-ranging set of phenomena in number theory and theory of motives in terms of objects of a different nature, which are automorphic functions, for example, modular functions, or automorphic representations. Anyway, objects which are part of the harmonic analysis. So number theory and harmonic analysis. And one of the very interesting features of this set of ideas, which kind of immediately captured people's imagination, was that there is a very important twist to the story, which is that you try to relate Galois representations, say, and then on the Galois side you have a particular group, and then in harmonic analysis you also have a group, and so at first glance, say in the abelian case, they would both be just GL1 or multiplicative group, or U1 if you prefer compact groups. But then when you go to the non-abelian realm, you realize that these are two different groups. That's what Langlands realized, two different groups. One of them is called Langlands dual of each other. So kind of, there's a sort of a involution on a set of equivalence classes of, say, deductive Lie groups. And so the important twist of the story is that you want to understand some phenomena which have to do with group G, and naturally a different group pops up, which is the Langlands dual group. So that was one development. And then independently, in late 70s, physicists studied non-abelian analogs of the electromagnetic duality. So non-abelian generalizations of electromagnetic duality. So what's electromagnetic duality? David?
No, there is a chair for you.
Thank you.
After that first day, we saved that chair.
Ask a question.
Question?
Who said question? What's Langlands' last name?
Yeah. Langlands. I'm glad someone's paying attention in this room. Okay, good.
That's electromagnetic.
Electromagnetic. I forgot to mention that there are a few letters that I promised not to say, not to write. I was on a bet, you know. So. But now I lost, so I might as well use all of them. So, electromagnetic duality. So, classical electromagnetism is described by Maxwell equations. So, when you teach multivariable calculus, which I'm going to do next year, you write them down, and so you write them, and they are written in terms of the electric field and magnetic field. And then very quickly you realize that there is a symmetry. You can switch electric field and minus magnetic field, and the equations will stay the same. So physicists wondered whether the same kind of phenomenon will also happen in quantum field theory. And there was a suggestion that indeed this should in some sense be true. But there is a sort of an important new twist to the story, which is that when you, the particle which carries the electric charge, the electron, under this duality of the quantum theory should actually correspond to a particle carrying magnetic charge, a magnetic monopole. And the other important aspect of this is that the electric charge under this duality will become its inverse. Will go to the inverse of the electric charge. So if you have a quantum field theory, which is weakly coupled, so it has very small electric charge, like in the real world, then the dual theory will actually have a very large electric charge. And this is a very important phenomenon because it indicates the existence of some non-perturbative physics. The existence of, it's like, for example, you know, think if it's a small parameter, you can try to write various correlation functions in your theory as a power series in E. But you don't know a priori that there is actually something of which this is a power expansion, power series expansion. But if you do believe that there is such a duality, this indicates that actually there is some function of E which not only, you know, exists, can be extended, analytically continued from the domain of small values of E, but also satisfies some sort of functional equation, like equation for modular function or something like this. Okay. So electromagnetism is described by what's called a gauge theory with an abelian gauge group, U1. Gauge group U1, just a circle. But we know that there are also non-abelian gauge theories, and they are very important also in the standard model of interactions between elementary particles, in the description of the weak and strong interactions. And so, the natural question is, what if you start with a gauge theory which has a gauge group, say you have a gauge group G and some coupling constant E, like the electric charge, and whether that would be dual to a theory with the same group and the inverse coupling constant. So G would now be non-abelian compact Lie group, like SUN, the group of n by n unitary matrices. And then, in the late 70s, people looked into this in more detail. In particular, Montone and Olive and Goddard, Knights and Olive in the late 70s, they observed that if for this duality to hold, something has to happen. And what has to happen is that if you have a group G on this side you have to have another group. And they didn't call it Langlands dual group because they didn't know about the work of Langlands. But if you look at it more closely, then you realize that, in fact, what they discovered is exactly the Langlands dual group, which appeared about 10 years earlier in the work of Langlands. Of course, there is a small subtlety, which is that a physicist work with compact Lie groups. At least they did at that time, maybe now. Mm-hmm. And so these are really the compact forms of this. This would be complex Lie groups, and this would be compact forms. But this duality works the same way for compact forms of complex Lie groups, as it does for the complex Lie groups themselves. Okay. So immediately that presented the question, why the same kind of duality at the level of Lie groups happens in two different contexts, one being Langlands program, and the other one being this electromagnetic duality, which later became known as S-duality. S-duality. And so that was. So already that in late Witten says that already in late 70s, Michael Atiyah noticed that this fact that that this happens, and he asked Witten what could it possibly mean. So for almost 30 years, question remained unanswered. And finally, about 4 years ago, there was a meeting at the Institute for Advanced Study, which I helped to organize, in which which brought together physicists and mathematicians to kind of brainstorm this and discuss how we could possibly think about these two pictures. And at the end of this meeting, Witten stood up and he gave a talk in which he gave an outline of a connection between the two subjects. Okay, and this is what I'm going to describe in these two lectures. I'll give you an overview of this correspondence between this beautiful mathematical picture of Langlands program and beautiful picture in physics called S-duality. So very roughly, the picture suggested by Witten and collaborators, in fact, the first work on the subject was by Kapustin and Witten, followed by a work of Gukov and Witten, and so I'll mention that later, and perhaps later in these lectures I will also talk about my work with Witten, which kind of further developed these ideas. So the picture that Kapustin and Witten had suggested, linking together these two stories, is the following. When I say gauge theory, I mean, of course, four-dimensional gauge theory. Like our world is four-dimensional. At least the world which is easy to observe is four-dimensional. I have to hedge that, I suppose, since it could actually be higher dimensional. Not lower, I suppose, but certainly could be higher. And so here, in the four-dimensional gauge theory, we have to start with a four-manifold. And what is gauge theory? It's really the study of connections on G-bundles. So you have to pick a gauge group, which is a compact E-group. And and you study G-bundles on M4 with connection, and then perhaps some other quantities like sections of spinor bundle, things like that. So what they suggested is that we have to look at this theory in a particular case when M is a product of two Riemann surfaces. So it's a product of two compact orientable two-dimensional manifolds. So that would be, let's call them sigma and x. So sigma and x are two Riemann surfaces. And then we look at the limit when x becomes very small. So we get effectively describe the resulting theory as a two-dimensional model. As a two-dimensional model, which now lives on sigma. As a two-dimensional model on sigma. And what this model is, this model describes now maps from sigma to a certain very special manifold, which is called the Hitchin moduli space. Hitchin moduli space. That's the word H is for Hitchin, and also for the word Higgs. This Hitchin moduli space is a moduli space of what's called Higgs bundles. Higgs bundles on X. Higgs G bundles on X. Now, I have to say, one important aspect of this is that S-duality really works nicely if you consider a supersymmetric extension of the of gauge theory. And in fact, things work in the nicest possible way when you look at the so-called N equal 4 super Young-Mills theory. Super Young-Mills or super gauge theory. Also with a particular twisting to actually, which would enable us to look at the topological sector of this theory. In other words, look at things which are invariant with respect to certain supercharges. So if we were to work with just bosonic theory, we would have maps from sigma to just the moduli space of G bundles. But because we work with supersymmetric version, there are some additional degrees of freedom, so what we end up with is so-called Higgs bundles. And I'll explain this in more detail a little bit later on. These are G bundles with some additional structure. So anyway, what started out its life as a supersymmetric Young-Mills theory on the product of sigma and X became a sigma model, a map, a theory which describes maps from one of the two Riemann surfaces, sigma, to a certain moduli space which is associated to X. And that moduli space is constructed for any choice of the group G, which was the original group in our gauge theory. Right? So now what will happen under the S-duality? Under the S-duality then, we should have some correspondence between the sigma model for the target manifold, which is a Hitchin moduli space for LG, and the sigma model for the Hitchin moduli space for the group G, right? So on one side we have the group gauge group is G, and on the other side is Langlands dual. So likewise, so the group G enters in through the definition of this Hitchin moduli space. So on one side we'll have the Hitchin moduli space for G, and on the other side we'll have the Hitchin moduli space for the Langlands dual of G. And so the S-duality between these two gauge theories should give us some correspondence between the corresponding sigma models. And in fact, what they argued is that what we get is what's called a mirror symmetry, what corresponds to, at the level of two-dimensional theories, to the S-duality of these four-dimensional theories, is a so-called mirror symmetry of the sigma models. Now, this was in fact known before. There were works by two groups of physicists in the mid-90s which explained this picture, that if you do what is called dimensional reduction from four dimensions, in other words, from this four-dimensional manifold to two dimensions, to this two-dimensional manifold, then S-duality should give rise to this mirror symmetry between the sigma models corresponding to the two dual Hitchin moduli spaces. What was new in the work of Kapustin and Witten is that they asked what this mirror symmetry does to the so-called D-brains. So look at D-brains. Look at the duality. Look at the duality at the level for D-brains. D-brains are certain objects which encode boundary conditions in these theories. In other words, as I said, let's think that sigma and X are two closed, kind of implicitly assume that sigma and X are closed Riemann surfaces. But in fact, we didn't have to assume that. We could have considered, we could have taken a sigma, a Riemann surface with a boundary. So it would look something like this. So there would be some holes, kind of, but then there will also be a boundary. So when you want to define your quantum field theory on such a Riemann surface with a boundary, you have to specify some boundary conditions. And these boundary conditions are, roughly speaking, encoded by these D-brains. So a very interesting and natural question would be, what does this mirror symmetry do to these brains? And of course, that would be a first approximation to asking what this S-duality does to boundary conditions already in the four-dimensional Young-Mills theory. That was the question which Kapustin and Witten asked. And what they showed is that in answering the question, this question, one recovers very much the same ingredients which show up in Langland's program. Or more precisely, ingredients which are very much analogous to the ingredients which show up in Langland's program. So now I have to... So this was a brief overview of the of this end of the story. In other words, the physics stuff. So now I have to start from the opposite end of Langland's program, so that eventually we'll meet. So we'll see how, indeed, what do I mean by saying that the duality, mirror symmetry of D brains, of categories of D brains, has something to do with the Langland's program. Okay. Any questions?
Yeah, how much dynamics of the original theorem is supposed to be contained in the reduction of the two dimensions?
Well, first of all, there isn't much dynamics because we're looking at the topological sectors, right? We're looking at the topological. Oh, this is only topological, right? So I have to say topological. Topological superiangles. And so these are going to be boundary conditions also preserving half of the supersymmetry.
That should capture some information about the supersymmetric boundary.
That is true. Right. So, but let me move over to the other end, which is mathematical end. And to, and I think the best way to think about it is in the following way. Actually, Langlands first formulated this ideas, what is now called Langlands program, in a letter to André Weil. He wrote it in 1967. Now, André Weil, in turn, wrote a letter to his sister in 1940. In fact, at the time he was in jail, being jailed by the French for refusing to serve in the army during the war. So he had a lot of time on his hands, I suppose. And so he wrote this letter, which I think is a really wonderful document, to his sister, who was not a mathematician, was a philosopher. Which I think is just the fact that he took, you know, time to write something for somebody who's not a mathematician, trying to explain ideas in a very pedestrian way, is remarkable. And unfortunately, we don't see enough examples of that happening these days. And so what he explained to her is that the power of analogy in mathematics, and I would say perhaps we should extend this and say power of analogy in mathematical physics, mathematics in and mathematical physics. And he was talking about a particular set of ideas, and he explained that there are sort of three trends, there are sort of three fields, areas of mathematics, which develop very much on parallel tracks. So what are these three tracks? One of them I will call number theory. This has to do with the study of numbers. So what kind of numbers? Well, we have integers, and then we have rational numbers. Rational numbers. So, and then what's next? Next, we can look at equations. With rational coefficients, polynomial equations with rational coefficients in one variable, and then of course they may not have solutions in the field of rational numbers. So the solutions would then be elements of a larger field, which is a field of algebraic numbers. So correspond, give rise to some algebraic extensions of the field of rational numbers. So this way, by adjoining the roots of polynomial equations with rational coefficients to Q, we get what's called algebraic closure of Q. And number theorists want to understand the structure of Q bar, essentially, right? So understand what these algebraic numbers look like. And as always, you gain a lot by looking at the symmetry of the problem, at all possible symmetries of the problem that you study. So the relevant symmetry group here is what's called the Galois group. Of Q bar over Q. And this is a group of of symmetries, or automorphisms, group of automorphisms of Q bar, which preserve Q pointwise. So this is a Galois group. So for example, if you just adjoin to Q the roots of this equation, you're going to get numbers of the form A plus BI, where I is one of the two solutions of this equation, the other one being negative I. And then here you have a natural symmetry which preserves the rational numbers, the rationals inside, being realized as numbers with B equal 0, namely the complex conjugation. So complex conjugation is an example of an element of the Galois group. It sends A plus BI to A minus BI and preserves all the operations, addition, multiplication, unit and zero, and inverse, right? And so, and preserves the rational numbers inside. So this is the vast generalization of this small group of symmetries that we observe in this sort of toy model. And we'd like to understand this group. And understanding this group in particular entails understanding its representations. So for example, you would want to consider n-dimensional representations of this group, which are the same as maps to GLN. Say, you want to realize this group by n non-degenerate matrices with complex coefficients. So this is one of the cornerstones of the Langlands program. Trying to understand this kind of Galois representations in terms of harmonic analysis. So that's the first track, number theory, which in the sort of in Andre Weil's picture. So what's are the other tracks? So then, sort of on the opposite end of this is the study of Riemann surfaces. So in this case, I'll just draw an example. Let's say without boundary now. So you want to study Riemann surfaces. These are complex varieties, right? Complex manifolds. And you have, for example, functions, the theory of neuromorphic functions, the theory of bundles, principal bundles on this Riemann surfaces, and moduli spaces of such, which we will soon discuss in more detail. So that's the second track. And at first, if you look at these two, they look like they're very far away. But then Andre Weil explains that there is a bridge. There's an actual bridge between the two. And to get to this bridge, we have to think about the Riemann surfaces more algebraically, as algebraic varieties. Think of them as algebraic varieties. In other words, as sets of points of think of their sets of points as sets of solutions of some algebraic equations. So, for instance, an elliptic curve, which we would just draw as a donut, as a torus, would can be corresponds to the equation y squared equals x cubed plus ax plus b, where a and b are two complex numbers, and you just look at complex solutions. Look at complex solutions. And then the set of such solutions, provided that A and B are generic enough, will be, apart from a point at infinity, would be precisely, could be represented as the torus. Likewise, you can represent curves with more holes by more sophisticated equations of this type. Once you talk about algebraic equations, it's very natural to switch from the field of complex numbers to any other field. In other words, you can look at this equation not necessarily when A and B are complex numbers and look at complex solutions, but you can say, for example, A and B are real, and you look at real solutions. But you can sort of make a more drastic switch and look at the case when A and B are elements of finite fields. And so this gives us the objects which live in the middle, namely algebraic curves, algebraic curves over defined over finite fields. So an example of an algebraic curve.
So first of all, a finite, what do finite fields look like for any prime p set 0, 1 up to p minus 1 with the natural operations of addition and multiplication, what p is a field. It's a finite field called fp with p elements. And more generally, for any power of a prime, there exists a finite field with q elements. Field with q elements. So they're sort of part of the universe of numbers, and just like complex numbers. And we can look at equations, for example, the same kind of equation, y squared equals x cubed plus ax plus b, when a and b are elements of this finite field, and you can look at solutions, x and y, which are also in f cubed, or f cubed squared, more precisely, because there are two components now, like before. And so, of course, now, if you draw it, it's going to be a finite set of points, but in fact, there is more to the story. You can look at solutions, not necessarily with values in FQ, but also in values in a finite extension of FQ. Because the field of complex numbers is already algebraically closed, but FQ is not algebraically closed. It has extensions which are going to be FQ prime, where Q prime divides Q. So you may actually look at it. So Q prime is some Q to B. So this set of algebraic geometers, after Groth and Dick, have learned to think about have learned not to be afraid of objects of this type. In other words, to think of this objects of this type in exactly the same way as objects of this type, over C or over finite field. And so André Weil's idea was that this theory of algebraic curves over finite field provides a much needed bridge between these two stories, which are very interesting. One is in number theory, the other one is in geometry. Riemann surfaces. And here you have this object which combines somehow properties of both. First of all, it's very close to this. This may not be immediately obvious because I looked at kind of a complicated curve. But I can look at a slightly simpler curve which would be just projective lines. So this was the torus, genus 1. But we can look at genus 0, for example. So in genus 0, you have P1 over finite field, right? And so actually it has, well, it's a union of the affine line, right? Which is just as a set of FQ points, is just a Q of them, just elements of FQ, plus we are joined point infinity. So there will be Q plus one FQ points, for example, if you want to draw it. But what's more interesting is to look, say, at the analog of the field of neuromorphic functions. So here we have neuromorphic functions, you know, the standard theory neuromorphic functions, and analogs of this would be just rational functions on this curve. What are rational functions on this curve? They will be just ratios of two polynomials. So you could choose relatively prime polynomials in one variable. And then such fractions give you neuromorphic functions, so to speak, more properly, rational functions on this projective line. And of course, if you look at this, and you also, this looks very much like the field of rational numbers, because field of rational numbers consists of fractions as well, p over q, where p and q are integers. So now we can see clear analogy. The analog of the ring of integers is the ring of polynomials in one variable over finite field. The analog of the field of rational numbers is the field of rational functions on p1. And so you see in what sense these two theories are very close to each other. This was, of course, discovered a long time ago and had been exploited by number theorists to understand many important phenomena in number theory. Why is this important? Why is this analogy important? It's important because in number theory, you don't immediately see any geometry. You don't immediately have any geometry. Somehow the numbers don't. It's hard to see any kind of inherent geometry in them. But here you have objects which are geometric, which are inherently geometric curves, even though these are curves over a finite field. Now, the connection between these two is more obvious. We just switched from, made our ground field from complex field into a finite field. And so what André Weil suggested is that we have to look at these three parallel tracks. And we have to look for analogies between the two. And we have to use that as a tool to discover new phenomena, new results in each of the three threads, in each of the three tracks. And he was very successful in doing so, of course, because what he did is he took the idea of Riemann zeta function, and he applied, which is something in this leftmost track, and he applied it here. And the result was the famous Weyl conjectures, which spurred tremendous progress in algebraic geometry ever since. So now I would venture to, since you know already what 69 years have passed since I wrote that letter, I would venture to add one more track to this, and I would say roughly, I would just say physics.
That was supposed to be written in the letter of his sister.
His sister to somebody else, but that letter was lost. So in other words, what this work of Kapustin-Witten and what this sort of circle of ideas about which I'm trying to tell you indicates is that actually there's more that, and of course there are other similar examples, have been many similar examples especially in the last 20, 30 years of very fruitful interaction also between mathematics and physics. And so it looks like that we can gain a lot by also using some ideas from physics, such as this idea of S-duality, to understand some of the phenomena here, and conversely, to use, say, the ideas of Langmuir's program to understand something about D-brain, say, and super Youngmans theory. But now, let me be a little bit more precise and tell you how the Langmuir's program fits in this picture. I sort of indicated some of the objects on this side, right? Because I talked about representations of the Galois groups. Right? So that's a starting, you can take that as a starting point of the Langlands program. So let me now say a little bit more precisely what the Langlands program is, and then we'll talk about how it sort of plays out in each of these four parallel tracks. So here in number theory we have the Galois groups, and the Galois group say of Q bar. More generally, we could look at a field such as, for example, this field obtained by adjoining the square root of -1, and likewise we'll have a Galois group of that, right? So the more general Galois groups. And so we want to understand representations of these Galois groups in terms of something else. And so Langlands' insight was that we could understand this in terms of some harmonic analysis. So how does it work? So I'll call this classical Langlands program. So Langlands program is about finding a correspondence between objects of two type. So it's kind of a duality, just like S-duality is a duality between two different theories. And on one side, we have these Galois representations. Let's say we look at n-dimensional representations of the Galois group. Say complex n-dimensional representations. More generally, we could look at what's called elliptic representations. So you look at GLN over QL bar, where QL is a field of elliptic numbers. So this way you get much a larger class of representations. But let's just for simplicity look at complex representations. So his idea was that this should correspond to objects of a different kind. And those are the so-called automorphic representations of GLN, again GLN, but whereas here it was complex GLN of C, this would be GLN over something else, which is called the adels. So adels is a product, is roughly just a product of all completions of rational numbers. So you have Eliotic numbers and then you have real numbers. But let's not worry about the details now. But I just want to emphasize the main idea. And the main idea is that on this side, we have something that has to do with the representation of the Galois group of Q. On this side, we have something completely different. We study representation, some natural class of representations of some infinite dimensional topological group. Right, so very large topological group. Right? So this actually has, there are examples of this correspondence in which this object can be made very concrete. Okay? So first of all, you can ask where do these Galois representations come from? Where could they possibly come from? And the answer is that they come from cohomology of algebraic varieties, which are defined over the field of rational numbers. So just like the usual cohomology, say if you have a smooth manifold, you can calculate this, say, singular cohomology or Durham cohomology, so you get some vector spaces. Now, there is a similar cohomology theory for varieties. So F with X is an algebraic variety. Over Q, there is a similar cohomology theory, the so-called et al. Cohomology theory. Which also gives you some vector spaces, and these vector spaces are now defined over the Eliotic numbers. But essentially, sort of the structure of these vector spaces are very similar to what you would expect to see just from the point of view of the sort of the ordinary cohomology. So the simplest case to look at then would be, say, if X is an elliptic curve, something which would again draw as, you know, as a torus, if we would just look at it as a complex curve, or, you know, as a Riemann surface. Likewise, you can look at it as a curve defined by this equation, where now a and b are rational numbers, you have a curve defined over the rationals. So then you'll have this et al. Cohomology, and the point is that here, the usual story would be that H0 is one-dimensional, H1 is two-dimensional, and H2 is one-dimensional. And exactly the same thing will happen for the et al. Cohomology, at least generically, when it's smooth. And so, in particular, the first et al. Cohomology would be two-dimensional. So now the point is that actually, because your variety is defined over Q, the symmetries from the Galois group will actually act on this et al. Cohomology. And so this way, you will get a natural representation, two-dimensional representation of this Galois group. So this would be a case when n is equal to 2, this n. Right? So what this means is that actually, studying these representations is not just some abstract exercise. These representations can be found in nature, in mathematical nature. Like this, right? So then Langlands tells us that these Galois representations should be related to some automorphic representations. So I want to give you a flavor of what kind of connection are we talking about. Well, the point is that there are various invariants which correspond to these two-dimensional representations. And in particular, one important invariant is for each prime, you can look at the number of solutions of this equation when you reduce everything mod p. So these are sort of numbers of points of this curve over fp. And so at first you look at the set of these numbers, and you don't, you know, they look like just some random sequence of numbers. But then the point is that actually the same numbers can also be obtained in a completely different way from harmonic analysis. Namely, there exists actually a particular automorphic representation for GL2, because now n is 2. And that automorphic representation can be encoded by something very classical and very concrete, namely a modular function, a modular form. So you're going to get a modular form. And what is a modular form? It's a function on the upper half plane, which has some nice, satisfies some nice functional equations. And this modular form, so you write it in terms of Q, where Q is e to the 2 pi I tau, and tau is in the upper half plane. And so you can write it in Fourier series. So you will have some Fn Q to the n, right? And in fact, it's going to be what's called cusp form, so we'll start with 1. And so then you can normalize it so that F1 is 1. And then what happens, so that what the Langlands program then tells us is that, in fact, you can recover these numbers from the coefficients of this modular form. In other words, for each elliptic curve like this, defined over the rationals, satisfying some conditions, you can find a modular form so that the coefficients of this modular form and its expansion will give you the numbers of solutions of this equation mod p for all primes. So there's like infinitely many equalities, right? So in other words, this is the generating function of this sort of set of random numbers which come from this elliptic curve and which come from the dollar representation actually gives rise to a modular function. It satisfies the function equation when tau goes to minus 1 over tau. So that's an absolutely surprising and unexpected result, and that's exactly, that's a very good illustration of what this Langlands correspondence looks like in general. So more precisely, I think the formula is minus 1 is f. So that's the thing. And of course, in this form, this is a special case of Langlands correspondence is actually known as Shimura-Taniyama-Wei conjecture. Taniyama-Wei conjecture, which has been proved by Wiles and others, and which implies the Fermat's last theorem.
Is there any interest in form that are not just cusp form?
Yes. Of course.
Because in the string theory, doesn't like the cusp form, because in the language of string perturbation, mm-hmm. cusp form, I think, is the vanished part of activity, so the non-cusp part is the
positive. That's right.
And the S-duality that you describe is the S-duality of string theory, so you naturally have all these theories that are non-cusp, so...
Right.
But that means, yeah.
Well, this is just an illustration, right? So it's an illustration when you have Galois representations coming from elliptic curves, right? But you have this Galois representation on this side, and you have modular forms on this side, right? But there are more modular forms than just cusp forms. There are also Eisenstein series, there are mass forms, right? And they should also correspond to some objects of this type as well. Under this correspondence. But this modularity has not always S-duality. Right. Because, we are still here. So we have to jump,
I understand, but I mean, just my question.
But certainly, in fact, Langlands started out by studying Eisenstein series. He wrote a book about Eisenstein series. And that's where he first noticed the strange phenomenon that somehow things look like there's some dual group appearing. So, in fact, he was very much motivated by study of Eisenstein series. So, Eisenstein series are very much part of the story. It may be this, in some sense, one of the most important examples. Okay, but I didn't want to give you precise formulation here. I just wanted to give you an idea what this looks like. And the important aspect is that really you're relating objects of very different nature, and the correspondence is very surprising, right? And it's very general. So you want to understand what's going on, right? And then where does the Langlands dual group come from? Or where does it enter the story? So you see here I have GLN, and then I have GLN, right? So there's no duality somehow. So we cannot recognize a dual group here. To see the dual group, we'd have to look at a more general case where GLN on this side is replaced by a more general group G. So reductive algebraic group. So for instance, it could be it could be GLN, our first example, but it could be also SLN, or it could be orthogonal group, say odd orthogonal, or it could be even orthogonal, or it could be symplectic, or E8. You know, so there are many choices, right? So then you try to see what those automorphic representations would correspond to. And naively, you would think, at first, if you actually believe this correspondence for GLN, the first guess would be that here you have to put G as well. But then Langlands' insight was that that's where you have to put the Langlands' dual. You have to look at the representations with values in the Langlands' dual, not the group itself. And then you would have some objects which would correspond to automorphic representations of this group G. So what are the Langlands' dual groups here? As I said, GLN is self-dual, so it would be very easy to miss this if we didn't care about other groups. Just like, you know, UN is self-dual, and so if you studied S-duality just for UN theories, you wouldn't know that there's something going on, something non-trivial going on. But for example, SLN is already not self-dual, its dual is PGLN, which is a quotient of SLN by the center, which is Z. And perhaps the most drastic change happens for all the orthogonal groups. Its dual is symplectic group. And then even orthogonal happens to be self-dual, and so is E8. In fact, E8 is in some sense the simplest one, because it has there is no center either, so there is no phenomenon like SLN, PGLN here.
Actually, the
SLN
is going
spin-covered. Yes, spin-covered. Well, it plays, and you can take any, then you'll have to take in the spin cover, there's Z2 cross Z2 center, so it has to divide by Z2 cross Z2. So it'll be SO2N divided by Z2. Right. So it's always for the duality, say if you have one which is simply connected, then the dual one would be adjoint types, no divided by center. And there will be some in the middle. This one is kind of in the middle, SO2N. Okay, so that's roughly the story. And actually for many, many years, this was just a big conjecture. And the first big break was the Weyl's work, Weyl's Taylor, on the proof of the special case, that Shimura-Taniyama way. And since then, actually, there have been a lot of development, which actually now people have, quite a few cases have been worked out of this, just in the last 2-3 years. More or less following the ideas of Weyl's and Taylor, and together with some new important results that have been proved. But now we really want to move over to this side. So we have to find a reformulation of this. Of course, in physics, so far, we are not thinking in terms of number fields or curves over finite fields, so we better start doing something for even surfaces. And in fact, this correspondence in this, yes?
These developments, the original goal of Langlands' program was to try to understand the left-hand side.
Right.
So in these developments, is the duality established first and then it's used knowing the right-hand side what something about the left-hand side, or it's just an independent check of comparison of both?
So you see here, you can see that there is a difference between this and, say, S-duality. S-duality is duality between two things which are very similar,
yes.
Gauge theories. It's just the group changes. Okay, but here these are two very different things. So this already, so we will address this issue when we get here. Now, but there, in the original motivation, the question was, this is really hard somehow, and this is easy in some sense. This is harmonic analysis, and how hard can it be? You just study some fully, you know, I'm kidding, but it's sort of it's something where you can, there is something you can do. And so the idea was to understand things like these numbers of points, AP, these numbers that I was talking about, numbers of solutions of this equation, say, when A and B are integers, mod P, which somehow you cannot control, so it's like really a transcendental question. And so the insight was that actually this can be found as coefficients of state modular form. So then you don't care, you don't worry much about going backwards, you know, because this already, the big thing is to go this way. Right? So that's sort of a difference between this and, say, S-duality. But we'll see somehow. We'll make it more symmetric as we move along this way. So now the point is that when you move from the leftmost colon to this colon, not much is going to change because, as I said, this really has to do with the Galois group of what? Of this field of rational numbers. And this field of rational numbers is very similar to this field, this is called a function field. Right. So what you're going to do is, likewise, you'll take the Galois group of this function field, and you will try to analyze homomorphisms. So you will look at Galois group of this function field, and you will, you know, analyze homomorphisms like this, where F is field of rational functions on a curve X defined over finite field. So, but the real challenge is to move from this column to this column, to really switch from finite field to complex field. And that's where we really have to reformulate this this correspondence. And so that leads us to what's called the geometric Langlands program, geometric Langlands correspondence. So we have to introduce objects of sort of geometric, replace all the objects which appear here by some geometric objects. Okay? And so what are these objects? So on the left, we have the Galois groups, right? And homomorphisms from the Galois groups to, say, LG or GLN. So we have to understand what is the geometric meaning of the Galois group. In the context, in the geometric context, when our field is no longer field of rational numbers, say, but, say, field of functions on some curve. And that's actually very easy to see. Very easy to see because we just have to remember what the Galois group is. It's the group of automorphisms of the algebraic closure. Now, suppose your field is a field of functions on some curve. And never mind, it's a curve of a finite field. I still drew it as if it were just, you know, say a real curve, a complex curve. So f is functions on this curve over some field K, and K could be complex field or could be finite field, anything you want. Then there is a very there is a clear construction, very clear geometric construction of extensions of this field. Namely, you just look at the covering. So let's say Y is a covering of X, and you have a field F prime, which is K of Y. Right? So F is functions, meromorphic functions here, and F prime is meromorphic functions here. Now, if you have a meromorphic function here, you can pull it back. So you have a natural inclusion. And this actually becomes an algebraic extension of this, because actually it's going to have a finite dimension over F. The dimension will be equal to the degree of the covering. So this is how you construct extensions. Now, what's the Galois group? The Galois group is a group of automorphisms. Say the Galois group of F prime over F is a group of automorphisms of this field which preserve this field. We can think of these automorphisms as coming from geometrically defined automorphisms of the curve. So then the condition that it preserves this subfield would mean that these are transformations of Y which are trivial, which induce trivial transformation on X. So these are just the deck transformations of the curve. Right? So this is just the deck transformation. Over cover, Y over X. And now, what is the Galois group of the closure? Well, the closure will correspond to sort of the biggest possible covering. And the Galois group of the closure would be the group of deck transformations of the maximal cover. And that's the fundamental group. So what this means is that the analog, the geometric analog of the Galois group is a fundamental group. And that's something which certainly makes sense when we replace a curve over a finite field by a curve over a complex field. So it becomes a very geometric notion. There's also a notion of a tau fundamental group in the case of curves over a finite field, which would be at play here if we were to work with a curve over a finite field. And so the objects on the left-hand side of the correspondence would then be replaced by homomorphisms from pi 1 to LG. Now, there is a... I'm kind of... lying a little bit, because if you really want to get the fundamental group, you have to insist that your cover is unramified. because fundamental group is a group of Dirac transformations of the maximum ramified cover. But you can construct extensions by taking also covers which are ramified somewhere. Still, it's okay, right? So in fact, the Galois group is bigger than the fundamental group. The Galois group is sort of, the Galois group is like the fundamental group of the curve with all points removed. In other words, if you only look at ramification at some fixed points, then you would get, as a Galois group, fundamental group of the curve without those points. But then in principle, you can remove as many points as you want. There is sort of a tower of fundamental groups, and the big Galois group itself is a kind of inverse limit of those groups. But we might as well, in the first approximation, to restrict ourselves to the unramified case. This is a quotient of the big Galois group, the unramified quotient. We might as well just focus on the unramified case and just look at those representations which factor through pi 1. So let's just do that. So that gives us a much needed geometric reformulation of the left-hand side of the correspondence, which we can now utilize in the third column, namely when we work with Riemann surfaces, complex algebraic curves. So next, we have to reformulate this, the right-hand side, and this will lead us to the moduli space. This will lead us naturally to the moduli space of G bundles on X. So not so far from the moduli of Higgs bundles which appear in the work of Kapust and Whipple. And the geometric Langlands correspondence will be a correspondence between this object and some objects, which I'll explain tomorrow, on this moduli space, which will satisfy a certain important property. So I'm out of time, so just to give you a little preview of what's coming up next is tomorrow I will explain in more detail what is the right-hand side of the geometric Langlands correspondence. And then in this form, this will still be kind of asymmetrical, just like here. But then I would cure that by kind of giving a more categorical description of this correspondence, where on both sides you would have categories, and the statement would be as an equivalence of certain categories. And then I will explain the connection to Kapust and Witten. But in two words, the connection is that the equivalence of categories which mathematicians are looking for, in which is the ultimate statement of the geometric Langlands correspondence, is actually equivalence of categories of grains in the sigma models associated to two dual Hitchin moduli space. So to understand precisely what this means, come back tomorrow.
Any questions from today?
Yes?
I just wanted to understand what's been proven here. I mean, you drew an arrow in both directions. Has the arrow been proven for like elliptic curves in both directions? That way?
Some things have been proved this way and some things have been proved that way. Now, everything I said should be sort of taken with a grain of salt because I didn't really define objects on both sides, right? So what I wanted to indicate that there is a correspondence between objects of this type, and in this setting, it's interesting to prove it this way and that way, and in many cases has been done. Say, Tanyama Shimura. For example, even in the case of Shimura Tanyama Wey conjecture, it's not obvious, you know, there are two non-trivial statements. One is, if you have an elliptic curve defined over the integers, right, then you count the number of points, points mod p, and that this should be coefficients, most of them should be coefficients of a module, or particular module form, right? So that's what was proved more recently. But there is another question is, okay, take any module form of that type, is it true that there exists an elliptic curve? So that was proved much earlier by Shimura, right? So in other words, you have similar statements in more general situation as well. But usually it's harder to prove this. Yes?
The relation to the S-duality of the Gauge theory set looks like you're using only a very squeezed version of the Gauge theory.
Yes.
You're not using the full four-dimensional
That's right.
nature or the two-dimensional theory.
Yes, that's right.
Is there any room in the Langlands program which will lead you to higher dimensions?
Yes, definitely. Well, first of all, since you mentioned the six-dimensional theory, I should probably say something about this, because
you can ask, what we are talking about is relating, say, the language program in mathematics and S-duality. So this is one question what we can ask. But another question is why? Why is there S-duality? Why is there a language program? And as far as language program, nobody knows. But as far as S-duality, there is sort of an answer, right? Because there is a conjectural theory, which is six-dimensional, on your four-dimensional manifold times an elliptic curve with complex parameter tau, right? And so the coupling constant becomes the parameter tau, but because the elliptic curve for tau and minus 1 over tau is the same, that's why you get the equivalence, right? So in other words, that's already interesting, because now this gives you kind of indication what could happen in principle in mathematics as well. But as far as, so another point, very good point, which Nikita was making is that so far it looks like we're only using a two-dimensional reduction of the four-dimensional Young-Mills. But in fact, it's only partially true, because in these problems, there are all kinds of, so there's sort of generic situation and there's kind of a less generic situation. And roughly speaking, the two-dimensional reduction is good enough when you only look at the generic situation. There are all kinds of singularities in these moduli spaces, and if you really want to understand what happens around those singularities, it looks like the only way to do it is to go back to the four-dimensional theory and to look at it more closely with not sort of like as a full-fledged four-dimensional theory rather than two-dimensional reduction.
What would it mean for the number theoretical language problem?
That's a very
some questions which you can only understand.
That's a very good, so that what's the four-dimensional theory in the mathematical approach? Mm-hmm. It's not known, but people are thinking about it. Right. What is the six-dimensional?
Let's thank Edward again.
So the Brown side, I mean, you can also think of this as a non-abelian Fourier transform.
That's right.
And I mentioned that to David once. He was sort of saying that pretty much everything in representation theory can be thought of as a non-abelian Fourier transform.